In case you didn't catch it, that was from the novel Parable of the Sower. Now, even in the beginning of Parable of the Sower, the world is not in good shape. Cities are in ruin, resources are scarce, violence and corruption are everywhere. It's all the result of the effects of climate change, growing wealth inequality, and corporate greed. It's the year 2024, which in 1993, when the book was published, must have seemed a long ways off. The narrator, Lauren, tells that about the promises of politicians that are going on everywhere early in the story. They're swearing that they can bring the country back to its glory days, reverse the effects of this current devastating reality. And most adults around her are holding on to this hope, making their choices based on that longing of going back. But not Lauren. She knows that it is too late. The change, it's already happened, and there is no going back. The old dreamed-for future is now, it's an impossibility. There is now an entirely different world ahead. And so all they can do, all they must do, is start preparing. This is a familiar tension to any of us who deal in the realm of trauma or loss. This tension between that longing for the past as it was before the loss, the desire to return to life, like just with the one thing different, but otherwise the same, us the same too. It's what we usually mean when we say that we're recovering from a loss. Recover as in return, restore to what was. But on the other side of that longing to return is a realization necessary but also painful. Sometimes as painful as the original loss. It is that moment when you realize there is no going back. There's no rewind button for life, the world, or the human heart. The loss, that is, the change, cannot be undone. You are already different. The world is already different, which means the future, that imagined future based on the world and life as it was before, it is no longer possible. And it's hard to know when you realize this if the grief is any more about the past and missing what was, or if it instead is now about the future and grieving what you thought would be. It's a mix, always, of course. As the news stories have been pouring in, stories of children being torn from their parents, I've been thinking about this tension and this realization. By the way, since the administration has taken to making religious claims, let's be clear, from our religious perspective, any God worthy of being called God cries with those parents, wails with those children, and condemns family separation and the criminalization of asylum seekers as terrorism. Or, to use a more traditionally religious word, evil. And this is what I have been realizing the past few days, that this experience of evil, this trauma, this loss, from this there is no going back. We may want to believe otherwise, we want to believe that we can fix it, get back to the world as it was, but there is no going back for those children, for their parents, there's no going back for the agents who took those children from their parents, there's no going back for the immigrants who have lived here for decades that are each day wondering what new cruelty will be packaged as law next. There is no going back. For our world. This world is forever changed. We could say the same thing about the many other evils that we face today, the ones that Lenny read in his reading or the many others, from these losses, there is no going back for any of us. These changes, they cannot be like undone. This is the world that we live in now. And so the only question before us is how? How will we live? How do we live in this world now? In her essay, After the Apocalypse, Unitarian Universalist theologian Rebecca Parker reminds us that for the most part, religious liberals have answered this question by either A, getting to work at trying to fix this world, or B, often when they realize that we can't fix it, deciding not to engage at all. As Parker says, we assign ourselves the task of dismantling evil empires, and we go to work. Think of the evil whose ruin we've tried to orchestrate: patriarchy, racism, homophobia, militarism, economic injustice, environmental abuse. We are so deeply committed to the ultimate good of life and of people in the world. We just cannot believe that things cannot be made right, that we can't believe that we wouldn't be able to deal with this evil, that we can't eradicate it and then get back to life as we had planned. Life without violence or chaos or risk, beautiful life, just life, peaceful life. Like the adults in the parable, we want to believe that whatever we are experiencing now, it is an aberration, but that regular life is still available if we just work hard enough. It takes a certain amount of privilege to have, in the first place, a so-called regular life to return to, and then to believe that somehow that danger, that violence could be fully eradicated, to believe that there is a fix that has eluded everyone up until now when we got involved. Even more, it takes a lot of privilege to decide when you feel tired or frustrated or unable to see those immediate results, to check out, disengage, step back, not in the way I was discussing last week, which was really, remember, about connecting more fully, but rather to step back, as in turn away, turn it off. Rebecca Parker doesn't say it explicitly in her essay, but this strong traditional orientation of Unitarian Universalists is likely connected to the overrepresentation of white folks in our congregations. White, upper, middle class, straight folks, like many of us here. One of the upsides to the downside of the past 2 years, however, is that a lot of the same demographic, a lot of us, have decided that even if we cannot be assured that we can fix it, we could no longer step back, as in check out. We had to see and show up and try. If you were at the congregational meeting, you heard me say that around January of this year, I saw in this community a kind of weariness set in. We'd finished the sometimes heartbreaking but mostly energizing and tangible work of companioning Ingrid and her kids in sanctuary. And then the adrenaline of that first year of what was for many an entirely new degree of activism, it was kind of dwindling. And we were facing the reality that despite a year of seeing and showing up and trying, the injustice and the cruelty, especially towards the poor and the marginalized, was only increasing. And so we find ourselves right smack in the middle of that realization that we cannot fix it, and there is no going back. This is the world today. The future that we had in mind, the future we've been holding on to for hope, it has changed too as a result. It is so painful to accept this, the grief not just for now, but for the future too. And yet, if we can stay with this grief, stay, as in not escape, not check out, as any teacher will tell you, if we can stay in the unsettling, in the dis-ease, then we might just grow and learn. We might just learn what it is that we need to survive, who it is that we need to be, not just in the world as it is, but in the world as it yet might be. Many of you, I know, have engaged in the work of Joanna Macy and her concept of active hope. That's the title of one of her books, or the subtitle, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. Macy is a Buddhist, a teacher, and a deep ecologist. She turned 89 last month, and she still has so much to teach us. You can find her videos, her recent videos on YouTube. There's so much wisdom there. Especially, she has things to teach us in learning how to keep going after we realize that there's no going back, that we can't fix it. Since the 90s, she's been teaching a practice she calls the work that reconnects, which is work that invites us to dive all the way in, dive into the pain of this realization, dive into suffering. This is not something that many of us want to hear, and not something that our culture teaches us a very smart or good thing to do. I mean, we are taught to avoid pain, not dive in, to numb it or at least ignore it. I mean, why else would there be so many tools available to us to help us along that path? From potato chips, so many varieties, to hyper-busyness, to shopping even at all hours now, to red wine, also many varieties, to words with friends, and to over-intellectualizing. These are just my list. I'm sure you have your own. The things that help you keep pain at a distance. Brené Brown's work does such a good job of describing why this habit our culture perpetuates is completely unhelpful. As she says, we cannot selectively numb emotions, it turns out. When we numb pain, we also numb joy. So if we want to feel joy, we have to also feel pain. We have to feel all the feelings, or we get none of the feelings. We can't skip over the ones we don't like grief or anger, despair. Just like there's no rewind for life, there's also no fast forward. The only way to the other side of pain is through it. The only way to the other side of this mess that we're in is to go through it. And here I want to give a nod back to Lenny's chalice lighting, because there is a link in our cultures, between our culture's tendency to avoid pain and messy feelings and patriarchy. And the way that patriarchy today shows up as toxic masculinity and the small, small boxes that we make for what it means to be a man or to be a father. If we're going to face the mess we're in without going crazy, we need to expand the boxes so that all of us believe in fathering and the capacity for all genders to engage with all the feelings. Because living in the world as it is, living in this world as it is requires all the feelings and feeling all the feelings. I know this can be terrifying because we are all, to various degrees, well practiced at avoiding unpleasantness. Touching even the surface of emotional distress, we can fear it'll be too much and we'll get sucked into despair and be unable to return. As Macy says, emotional distress can be motivating and clarifying, but if it goes beyond what we imagine that we can cope with, we may just shut down. In our communities of care, like in this community, we often get the chance to engage with the more painful emotions, that emotional distress, especially in our small groups or when we serve together. Moments come up that bring to the surface at least a degree of pain. But too often our response in these moments is to try to help each other, which, I mean, the helping each other is good, but the way we try to help each other is by helping each other simply feel better. We confuse compassion with providing relief. But compassion simply means feeling with, staying present to all the emotions and offering each other that encouragement, the confidence that we can keep going, we can stay put, even when it hurts. In these connections, we can help each other grow our tolerance for truth-telling and truth-receiving in ways that aren't just about fixing, but about simply bearing witness, about knowing life more expansively, to keep realizing and to keep feeling this is the world we live in. I first heard that excerpt from the parable about Lauren's grab-and-run bag on the podcast from Adrienne Marie Brown and her sister Autumn Brown. It's an episode where they're getting very practical about how to survive in a catastrophic disaster, like along the lines of all of those things that she lists out there. But before they get to those kinds of practical tools, they start by saying that the most important survival tool any of us could pack would be to know and be known by our neighbors. They mean literal neighbors. But I'd expand it to mean any of these connections that create these communities of care. And say, if we are going to live in this world without burning ourselves out, if we are going to survive in this world, the most important thing for our grab and run bag has to be these connections. These meaningful connections where we practice sharing our resources with each other generously, where we laugh and play and stay in touch with beauty, where we can try out those small, compelling experiments and then learn the skills that we're going to need for the world that is not at all what we were expecting, but that now we are creating together, where we can plant seeds for the future and see what grows. The practical things that Lauren collects seem very important as well, so we should probably pack them too. But none of these matter without these connections. And one more thing. Luckily, there are those among us for whom terrorism and trauma and catastrophe is not at all new. People of color, poor people, gender nonconforming people, immigrants, those who long ago learned how to live in this world because they had no other option. And then though they, in turn, found ways to live among the ruins with honesty, creativity, curiosity, and even joy. Now is the time to follow their lead. Because the world has changed. It is not as we thought. What we are facing is not a blip, a detour, because there is no rewind button and there is no fast forward. The only way to the other side is through it. We have to live in this world as it is, taking it all in and giving thanks for this chance to connect and to survive. May it be so, and amen.